God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. For an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, especially you. And I introduce Tim.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name's Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Third week, and still all you people are here. That's wonderful. So to start off, as usual, my disclaimer is that this is my experience, strength, and hope with the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, known as the Big Book. And I do not speak for AA. It's my opinion. It's not AA's opinion, although there will be times when it does sound like I'm speaking for AA, so I apologize in advance for that. And so it is my belief that anybody who is going through the process of recovery should have a big book between them and their sponsor. So to that end, this is kind of what you would get as if you were sitting across the table with me with a big book between us. So, before I get into the book itself, we're going to start with Bill's story tonight. And I thought it was appropriate that I start with a little story that just happened to me last week. Last Monday, I was asked to speak at a meeting under false pretenses. I was asked to speak, and when I got to the meeting, I was blindsided by the format of the meeting. In the fifth chapter and how it works, it talks about there's a blurb about there are those of us who suffer from grave emotional mental disorders, but many of us do recover if we have the capacity to be honest. And so that's, for the first time in 19 and a half years of recovery, I was asked to speak a certain way. I was actually instructed about how I was supposed to speak. And I said, well, I'm not doing that. I said, my story is my story, and I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope about my alcoholism, not about that stuff. And unbelievably, this person who was sober less than 30 days decided to get into a row with me about, well, this is how it was in the beginning, and I was dumbfounded by it. And I said, no, actually, we have a singleness of purpose, and it's called the fifth tradition. You know, that we have but one purpose, to carry our message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And so it got to a point where I said, well, you can find somebody else to speak. Have a good night. And I got up and I left the meeting, and within 2 minutes, this person ran me down in the parking lot and wanted to engage in more arguments about it. And I just thought that it was amazing that I went to an AA meeting to speak about alcoholism and was leaving because I wanted to speak about alcoholism. And I just thought that was absolutely amazing to me. So to put that out there, and the reason I bring that up is because in Bill's story, he does mention some other issues that he dealt with and that he dealt with throughout his recovery, but his focus was always on his recovery from his alcoholism. I think it's wonderful that the meat and potatoes, if you will, of the big book starts with his story, and the story section starts with Dr. Bob's story. So I think it's pretty cool how they're sandwiched that way. And I often hear things like, it's just people's experience, strength, and hope, and that's all it is. You know, take what you want and leave the rest. And there's some things within Bill's story that talks about that specifically. And for me, it's very evident throughout the big book that in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, and through histories that I've read, and official histories, one which I have in front of me is called Pass It On, and it's the Alcoholics Anonymous World Services official history of Bill Wilson and his biography. I mean, there's plenty of them out there and probably have some other pieces of facts, but this is the one that, as a society, we sanction. And I invite everyone to really get a hold of it. There's a lot of things in there that go directly against things that are shared in the meeting. The one thing off the top of my head is specifically about Bill Wilson being asked if he would change anything in the book, and it would be rarely to never. And there's a story in this book that says he never said that. So it's kind of interesting how those word-of-mouth things get passed on, and I'm a big believer in, where's that written? To that end, I think it's wonderful that Bill was kind enough to give us a recount of his, experience, strength, and hope, and what it was like, and what happened, and what it was like after he recovered. I thought that was a a pretty good way, because my first sponsor always said, well, Tim, all we have is ourselves as examples. So I think it's wonderful that he put himself as the first example. You know, either by design or by ego or whatever it is, it's still the first story in the book. So I'd like to begin with that. So as usual, I try to read through it and I comment on it along the way. Chapter 1, Bill's story. War fever ran high in the New England town to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned, and we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. It was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time we sailed for over there, I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. Now, I think it's very funny in telling that he talked about my people. You know, in the first paragraph of his story, he's already talking about my people. And obviously that's referring to his family and his background. His background is really interesting, and if you haven't, like, read about his early years and before this period of his life, it's in Pass It On, and it's really, wow. It kind of, you know, he was from a divorced home, you know, and that back then, I mean, wow. You know, at the turn of the 20th century, to be from a divorced home was just an amazing thing. And it's often talked about causality of why alcoholics or other addicts or whatever turn to some sort of substance, and divorce is generally in that mix somewhere. So I find that that's interesting. And, you know, obviously he was talking about World War I. That's over there was the theme song for that. And then later on in World War II became that again. Now, this was 1917 is when he was inducted into the Army. And those are facts, too, so you can find them. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. I've much moved. I've wandered outside. Now, that's a really brief of, like, you know, he arrived in England and they went to a cathedral. It really kind of didn't work. He was there for months, and there was an epidemic going on at the time, so they were kind of they were forced to stay in quarters and couldn't get out. So, you know, and he talks about his waves of depression hitting him and finding ways to get outside of it, and that's what led him to that cathedral. So it wasn't just like, hey, I'm here, cathedral. You know, it was the circumstances of events going on. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone, and in front of me, in this copy of Webster's Comprehensive Illustrated Dictionary, the definition of doggerel, a kind of verse devoid of sense or rhythm. I find that interesting. So here's what it said. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. And in this instance, by pot is from drinking too much. It's not from the pot that we know today. Or being hit by a pot. So it's interesting right there that that tombstone that was actually the name on that was Thomas T, as it's described. And he goes on to describe that the difference in the last names between he and his sponsor, Ebby Thatcher, Ebby T, there was one letter difference between the last names. So he felt like maybe he could have been standing in front of, you know, one of Thatcher's ancestors. So, you know, it's all those woo stuff that goes on, you know, that voodoo of AA, you know. So that's interesting there. Ominous warning, which I failed to heed. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars. I went home at last. So, you know, 1919 is when it ended. That's when he came home. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation. And according to history and what's reported about that, the tokens of appreciation that he was given was a watch with a chain and a ring that was inscribed by his battalion. So those were one of them, I believe, is in Stepping Stone still, right in a showcase next to that page that shows that. But the watch and the chain, obviously, we don't know where that is. And he always talked about how moving that was, that, you know, at the end of the war, here he was given this by his fellow soldiers, you know, that's being lifted up. Here he was, 22 years old, a veteran of foreign wars, a leader, presence, you know, like, I'm ready to go. My talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. I don't know about anybody else, but my imagination was quite like Bill Wilson. You know, like, by the time I was this age, this was going to happen by the time this... You know, my five-year plan always changed every 2 years, you know, like, that's kind of how it worked for me. I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? Another good example of that self-delusion that alcoholics have, you know. I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. I could certainly identify with that. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. How dare she? Right? We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. Yeah. Obviously, one of the first people that comes to mind with that is Hemingway, of course, and all the philosophy. There was a movie that I saw years ago, and I'm sure some of you have seen it, and due to our traditions, I'll keep the name anonymous, but the goof is that they're in the unemployment line, you know, and he's a stand-up philosopher, and the woman says, "Oh, you're a BS artist." You know, so I say, okay, well, that kind of fits right there, right? By the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Supposedly, the only people in the world that really know how to make boomerangs are the Aborigines of Australia. And ironically enough, and kind of foreshadowing, is that Bill's genius was that he actually made a boomerang that worked. And literally almost cut him to ribbons, because you have to be taught how to throw it and catch it. So he knew how to throw it. But, you know, catching was a different story. So to me, that's, you know, Bill Wilson, although a very flawed human and individual, to me was just an incredible genius and definitely a vessel. That's how I see it. So, yes, living modestly, my wife and I had saved $1,000. It went to certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. And here we go. We're about to talk about, if you ever get a chance to get a copy of Lois's diary from this time, it's really a really interesting read. We gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle, the sidecar stuffed with tent blankets and a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success in speculation, so we had a little money, though we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year, which is, at the time, a lot of money. Now, like I said about that, they roared off on a Harley, and many a night, according to Lois's writings and recollections, she had to drive it because he was too soused to drive. So he was stuck in the sidecar, and here's Lois cruising along on the Harley with her drunk husband passed out next to her. So, I always find it very interesting that the picture of Lois sometimes is painted as a meek woman who, you know, was a victim. And, you know, according to her writings, she was no victim. She was a willing participant in a lot of this stuff, you know. So it's interesting to see that. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part of my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair-weathered friends. Now, to me, I never had paper millions, except maybe if we played Monopoly or Life or something, but I certainly identify with the grandiose ideas and talking in the bars about how much more important I really was when I really wasn't that important. And the fair-weathered friends were certainly there. You know, if I was buying the pitcher that night or if I were buying the round, boy, they were there. I had friends aplenty, you know. So interesting that here's a man talking about this going on in the 20s, and I was doing it 60 years later. You know, so really a lot really didn't change there that much. So my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by my extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes, which is an interesting statement there. First of all, the lone wolf thing, I mean, I don't know if anybody else can identify with that. It was, you know, like, drinking brought people into my life, and as they hung around more and more, it took those same people out of my life because of the drinking. So I was that person, too. I knew you like that night, you were my best friend that night, and then you were gone the next day, and what happened, where's my money, that stuff. But it's interesting that he wrote there had been no real infidelity. And that it was helped at times by extreme drunkenness. Now, yeah. So you kind of got it there, okay? You know, and it's interesting that his candor in writing that, you know, having written this in even in 1938 when he wrote it, and having. I don't know, some people may say he was crazy for writing that, you know, like, because obviously I'm sure Lois read this. But just to put that out there, again, is him using himself as an example of kind of how this was really supposed to work. In 1929, I contracted golf fever. On a personal note, I don't know how anybody can contract golf fever. So, we went at once to the country, my wife to applaud while I started to overtake Walter Hagen. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. It was fun to carom around the exclusive course, which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Abruptly, in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after market had closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ minus 32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many of my friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. My friends had dropped several millions since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. And I definitely experienced that almost every time I drank. There was always that, you know... And it was usually after the despair first. There was always the, oh, I don't know, and then it was, oh, I'm going to take over the world, you know. And then, you know, and then despair or getting punched usually came after, you know. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left, and I thought I had better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me, but drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. We went to live with my wife's parents. I found a job, then lost it as the result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years, or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. Now, it's interesting to see the picture that he's painting of where he was going as the result of the drinking. To go from a man who, you know, had these wonderful ideas and, you know, just the fact that he had that opportunistic view of like, oh, hey, my rich friend in Montreal has money, I'm going up there. And then, of course, drinking took that all away and it was broke. So, you know, I certainly had, even in my young days, had glimpses of that. Like, for me, it wasn't a rich person in Montreal. It was kind of like, well, who had a roof? You know, like, whose apartment? Who had the drink? Oh, there's a keg over here tonight, you know, and that was kind of my driving force. Because I, you know, fortunately for me, and I do say fortunately, I had no illusions about who I was. You know, I was certainly a drunk and proud of it. It was a rite of passage for me. You know, I was an Irish Catholic drunk. You know, leave me alone. And so that's how it was. His wife's parents. Interesting. Lois's father was a doctor, and they went to live in Brooklyn. And Clinton Street in Brooklyn is where the house was. So I found that interesting that, once again, you know, if you read Passing On, it shows that Phil Wilson's academic success was meager at best. I mean, he barely graduated high school. He didn't do well in the post-high school education that he was involved in. And even more importantly, I find it interesting to note that the school that he went to was a seminary school. So it kind of plays into the rejection of religious ideas and then the incorporation of them in this book. So for Bill to be able to really... And Lois was older than Bill. I think she was like 4 years older than Bill when they met. And, well... forever, really. And wasn't like he caught up, you know. So I found that was interesting, that here's a young man who really had no success in academia, who really didn't have any money when he met her, and he ended up marrying the doctor's daughter, who was well-to-do and came from this gorgeous brownstone on Clinton Street in Brooklyn. And just, so, you know, it just really sets up describing later on in the chapters that, you know, finding the best women on earth, and he was certainly talking about himself. Me, unfortunately, I haven't found that yet, but I'm still looking. So, liquor ceased to be a luxury, and now he starts to talk about, you know, how it turned, how, you know, as Chris talked about last week, with crossing that imaginary line, you know, drinking to the point where we become... You know, it's no longer, hey, I'd like to have a drink. It's, oh my God, I need a drink. So he starts to get into this. It became a necessity. Bathtub gin, quote unquote, 2 bottles a day and often 3 got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumblerful of gin, followed by 6 bottles of beer, would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hopes. One of the things that I always find interesting about Alcoholics Anonymous, and then the stories that were told and written, and especially Bill's, is that this all happened during Prohibition, when the production, consumption, sale, purchase, anything about alcohol was illegal. And yet, here was the, you know, that didn't stop anybody. So I'm wondering how come, you know, here's the political statement of the evening. We haven't really learned from that in our present-day society. So think what you will about that. Gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a compromising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. Now, I'm not sure, I haven't been able to piece together, somebody else might know that Lois was pregnant at one time and had a miscarriage. And I don't know if that's what he's talking about in this time period. Maybe somebody else knows that. But it's important to note that because, it would certainly affect anybody. You know, not much less somebody who thought they were going to conquer the world, you know. But then here's, once again, you know, that statement of Phil Wilson's genius. Like, here he is, the low point, the stocks are at a low point in 1932, and he manages to convince a whole bunch of people to invest money in the stock market in the Great Depression. That's just, to me, that's just brilliant. I mean, here's a guy who epitomizes selling ice to Eskimos. You know, that was him. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw. I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed, this time I meant business. And so I did. Those sweet promises that he wrote were in the margins of their family Bible. He would go and write little messages for Lois and particular readings in his Bible and tell her where to go and find them. So I was kind of like, wow, that's pretty heavy. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. And I think that's funny. We talked about that in the doctor's opinion about those, you know, always the dramatic of being through forever but never making a decision. And he talks about that in his story right there. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. So there's, like, here we are on page 5, and the think the drink through statement that we always hear in meetings, right out the window, didn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed to near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the Jim Mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time. But I might as well get good drunk then, and I did. I understand that. I can't identify with that. Because there was never, I won't do it, or I'll control it next time. That wasn't an illusion for me. I do understand that other people go through that, that it kind of that self delusion once again. That I can handle it. And in our grapevine, our meeting in print, you know, there's a comic every month. They put a comic called Victor E. And it's always this struggle, being right on the edge of taking a drink. And, you know, so something comes along and happens where he ends up going and doing something else instead of going into the bar to take a drink. So, but for me, that was never something I identified with, because if I was going into a bar, it was to drink. It was never to just use the telephone. It was never some trivial excuse. It was for the purpose of what I was doing there. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. You know, and he begins to talk about hopelessness, the hopeless feature of alcoholism that I know I was hopeless when I got here. Because, you know, if I had any ideas, you know, if I could have done it differently, and I wouldn't have stayed here. I was hopeless when I got here. My ideas were done. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. The morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. 2 bottles and oblivion. I definitely identify with that. That my life is just, what should I do? And I mean, fortunately for me, I was definitely too cowardice to take my own life. You know, and so I would find something that would fix that, and it usually did. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine, endure this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse. When the morning terror and madness were on me, again, I swayed dizzily before an open window, or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. And once again, you know, he talked about that earlier, and now it's just becoming the necessity of the, as we talk about it in the rooms, the doing the geographical cure. Like, if I go there, it'll be different. I come back here, it'll be different. And so that started going on a lot more. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor, lest I suddenly leap. The doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rock. People feared for my sanity, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. The sedative, at the time that they used, was laudanum, which is a tincture that was a combination of opium and other things. Hops a lot, you know, so it had a lot of the ingredients of liquor at the time. So, my brother-in-law was a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. Obviously, that was Towns Hospital in New York, which is no longer there, unfortunately. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Interesting, you know, the so-called belladonna, you know, beautiful mother, but it was a hallucinogenic drug that had the properties of atrophying muscles to stave off the effects of delirium tremens and the shakes. So that's why they used it. So, which, like, you wouldn't shake, you know, but you'd be frozen. So, and I guess you would probably see real cool things. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that, though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. And of course, we know that it was Silkworth, and he talked about that his, you know, his theory was later proved to be a physical allergy to the alcohol and the mental obsession that caused the whole cycle of here we go again. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely, this was the answer. Self-knowledge. How often I hear in meetings, you know, I come to meetings and I say I'm an alcoholic, and that's, you know, I just have to remind myself I'm an alcoholic. And, it, you know, he talks about that earlier, and he's going to go on to you know, his very next statement is, but it was not. Self-knowledge was not the answer. You know, if it were just as simple as me saying, oh, well, I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink, well, I certainly wouldn't have come to AA. And I certainly wouldn't continue to come to AA. If it was as simple as that for me, there'd be no reason for me to be here. And I'm sure a lot of people would be grateful if it were that simple. But for me, that self-knowledge, it's just of no use. And he talks about that earlier in his story. I mean, he knew what, you know, that he couldn't take a drink, but somebody pushed it toward him and he picked it up and drank it. So, you know, he started talking about his sanity and all that, right? Self-knowledge, yeah, self-knowledge, I hear about that constantly in AA meetings, and it's just, I'll argue about that later. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge, but it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. Interesting that, you know, one of the things that we often hear, that alcoholism, you know, usually ends with some sort of jail, institution, or death. And here he is talking about institution or death. And when he says it, I knew and almost welcomed the idea. I don't know how anybody else felt, but I knew when I was drinking, it was for that purpose. At a particular point, when I got to the hopelessness of my alcoholism, and I was doing insane things like riding on the hoods of people's cars and holding on and going, "Come on, man, knock me off!" You know, it was a half-hearted, like, "God, when is this going to be over?" You know, that feeling of coming to and thinking, "Oh my God, I got to do another one of these days." You know, and so when I read that, I knew and almost welcomed the idea. I definitely understood where he was coming from, that's for sure. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness, after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And that paragraph right there, I have certainly felt that. That feeling, you know, and alcohol was definitely my master, for sure. For sure it was my master. I was faithful to alcohol, for sure. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Oh, and here's my next favorite. Fear sobered me for a while. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink on Armistice Day, 1934, and I was off again. I can't, you know, it's talked about later on in the book in more detail, but I've never experienced in my life a healthy fear. Ever. I've never experienced a healthy fear. My instinct to survive, to not put my hand in the hot flame, isn't a fear. It's something that the first time I put my hand in the flame, I wasn't afraid. And it was the burning of my hand that taught me that lesson. So when I always feel sad when I hear people say, "Oh boy, I'm afraid of alcohol," because for me, that, you know, and it talks about that right there in the story. That's just doom. You know, the fear of the alcohol has to be replaced by the higher power taking over and keeping you safe from that. You know, that's been my experience, and anybody I've ever seen that does that, that replaces the fear with the faith, has remained safe and away from and alcohol. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted in what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that was incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through the night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I could remember him coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he escaped. Of course, we would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him, unmindful of his welfare. I thought of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we had chartered an airplane to a complete jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that. The door opened and he stood there, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed, but curious, I wondered what had gotten into the fellow. He wasn't himself. "Come, what's all this about? I queried. He looked straight at me. Simply but smiling, he said, "I've got religion." Just like that, right? I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcohol crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right, but bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. I just find that very funny. No gin has ever lasted longer than my preaching, for sure. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. That happened to me. You know, I had court stuff going on probably about 4 months after I got sober, and two guys from AA showed up and vouched for me. I let them know, hey, I was going to go to court, and they showed up. And the judge called on them, and he said, have you seen him at meetings? Has he been going? Yeah, I see him all the time, and dismissed. And it was amazing because I was the only person that walked out of there dismissed. Wow. I mean, they were changing like, okay, we'll give you a smaller fine, but nothing. I walked out of there with nothing. And really, to me, whenever I read this, I always think of my experience with that, and I think how cool it was. The two men were Roland Hazard and Sebra G, and they were members of the Oxford Group at the time. And they came because Roland Hazard was a friend of the Thatcher family, and went and saved their son, really, is what happened. So, to me, that's really cool. The first example of how sponsorship can really work, how it can really turn somebody's life around. And if it weren't for those two men, I wouldn't be sitting here. I always say that kind of stuff. So, they had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass his experience along to me, if I cared to have it. I was shocked, but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. He talked for hours. I love that. I think we should talk for hours more often. You know, I have a guy who I sponsor who's in the room tonight. I'm sure he probably thinks, God, I wish he wouldn't. Childhood memories rose up before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays, way over there on the hillside. There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings. He had his insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. That wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back again. Now he's going to start to turn around and talk about that moment of clarity. You know, because this happened before he went to the hospital again. That moment of clarity. Just before, like, oh, yeah. That little, I like, you know, in California they call them God shots. I kind of like that. I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe, who knew neither time nor limitation. But that was as far as I had gone. With ministers, the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. And for those of you who remember, 14 years of Catholic school, they said wonderful things, but when it became that blanketed in fear, do this or else stuff, that's where I parted right there. You know, because for me, like, God wasn't punishing to me, so I couldn't groove with what they were trying to tell me. So, and then here's the first point. This next thing is where he kind of talks about take what you want and leave the rest. Doesn't really work because it didn't work for him. And he kind of like puts that out there. He says, to Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. His moral teaching, most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. You know, so obviously, by doing that, he got where he got. You know, the wars which had been fought, the burnings and chicanery that religious disputes facilitated made me sick. I honestly doubted whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I had seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible. The brotherhood of man, a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me. And he certainly had me too. Sure did. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Now, that right there, I certainly identify with all of that. And the human will part of it. His human will had failed. Now, for me, when I'm running things, I fail. All the time. When I have a great idea, I have an idea, and if I don't, pause, and if I don't start to think about, well, where's that idea coming from? Is it selfish? I need to talk to a sponsor. I need to talk to my network. I need to talk to people that I trust about, hey, let me run this idea. And a lot of times, what is coming out, I have this idea and I start talking about it, it just sounds ridiculous, you know? And then I go, oh, there's my human will again. So it talks about here, you know, that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. Now, I know for me, my experience was that when I quit drinking, I wanted to drink every day for at least 18 months, regardless as to the fact that I went through the steps, had a spiritual awakening as the result of them. I still had that obsession that I just wasn't breaking through yet, you know, and I kept hanging on, and I kept going, and I kept doing it. I said, okay, it's another 5 minutes, just for today. Then I remember, at about 18 months, there was a day that I thought, oh, wow, I didn't think about drinking yesterday. And then I went, it worked! And then I thought about drinking, you know? I mean, that's how it worked. But I couldn't believe it, and I thought, oh, my, wow, that's what they're talking about, because God did that. I didn't do that. I thought about drinking all the time. God said, all right, okay, you get a day. You don't have to think about it today. And I just thought, oh, wow. So from that point forward, it was kind of and he'll talk about this in a couple pages. Just, I can hang on. That's all right. God gave me a day. If God gave me one day, God can give me another day without thinking about it. And that has proven to be true in my life. And he says, had this power originated in him? Obviously, it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute. And this was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Just like my story. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped the new soil. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. Wow, I experience that all the time when I work with somebody new. I've said this before, I say this all the time. You know, to me, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life is when I hear things like, I couldn't ever imagine you with a drinking problem. You know, to me, that's how this program works in my life. So, the word God still arouses a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, and here's important words, why don't you choose your own conception of God? That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. That's a pretty poignant statement right there. I mean, I've experienced that, and I continue to experience that, because I don't know if anybody else goes through this, but I have a tendency to build icy mountains of intellectual pride constantly. You know, and then I'm like, oh my God, I'm cold. And then I realized, oh, it's my mountain again. And it becomes like, oh, well, where's God? And then it starts to melt, and oh, I'm in the sunlight at last. I go, oh, that's right. So it just never ends. It's a constant thing with me. So here we go. Here's that wonderful italics, important stuff. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. So, you know, to me, it's important to note the willing part and beginning. Because for me, that's what I needed. I needed to have that willing, you know, I needed to be eagerly compliant. It's one of the definitions I've found. Or cheerfully, a cheerful choice is being willing. You know, just to make a beginning. I didn't have to finish there, but just a beginning, you know, and that was cool. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Thus I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him enough. At long last I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have Him with me, and He came. But soon, the sense of His presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself, and so it had been ever since, how blind I had been. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. And that was the last time he went into the hospital, was December 11th, 1934. There I humbly... Now he's going to talk about the process of going through the steps before even leaving the hospital. There I humbly offered myself to God, as I then understood Him, to do with me as He would. I placed myself unreservedly in His care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without Him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend, with a capital F, take them away, root and branch. I have not had a drink since. My schoolmate visited me. I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. Now, this is really cool, this next thing he's about to say. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my new problems as He would have me. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive. But that would be in great measure. Now to me, that right there, you know, talks about later on in the book also that, you know, God gave His brains to use. And I just get so tired of hearing, you know, if I'm doing the thinking, something's wrong. Well, I don't know who else is supposed to do the thinking for me. You know, like, really. And it talks about the new God consciousness. So now my thinking is different. My thinking is different today than it was all those years ago. I'm not thinking about me all the time. I'd be lying to you if I told you that I don't think about me. But it's not all the time. It's not when I first, you know, like when I first came in, that expression of I'm not much but all I think about really pertained to me. You know, and now, and it talks about that because, you know, the 11th step, that only, I love the word only because it really narrows things down for me. It makes it singular. It doesn't give me a choice. So what I'm only supposed to be doing, you know, only might I expect to receive when I'm praying for other people. When I'm praying for other people and how I may help them, you know, and to me, that, you know, that goes with every religion I've ever studied in my life. Because I studied them, you know. I wanted to see what they had to say. So, and my life, things have been in great measure in my life. So, then he says, my friend promised that when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain that new order of things were essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. Once again, we hear, this is not a selfish program. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. All things, not just my drinking, all things. Right? These were revolutionary and drastic proposals. Revolutionary, meaning to overthrow an old way of doing things and replacing it with a new. Right? But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory, followed by such a peace and serenity as I had ever known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up, as though a great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. For a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I was still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, "Something has happened to you. I don't understand. But you'd better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were." The good doctor now sees many men who have such experiences. He knows that they are real. Now, it's important that, you know, he knows that they are real. Because, like it says, he was under the belladonna treatment, the hallucinogenic part of things. You know, there are AA's oppositional skeptics out there. You know, they love to bring up the fact, oh, his experience was some hallucinogenic thing. You know, and it became like a point of contention. You know, so he wrote that he's experienced people doing that many times since Bill, and he knows that they're real, that they're not just some drug-induced, like, oh, trip, you know. It has happened. I can tell you from my personal experience, it's happened to me. It happened to me years ago when the words, "I'm going to die," came out of my mouth. That wasn't me, and I wasn't on belladonna. You know, it does happen. Okay. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came to me that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity, redundant, of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, which was Dr. Smith's wife, Anne. That was her favorite quote from the Bible. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. Now, here's an incredible point of contention that I absolutely love. Right? It says, "For, if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain low spots and trials ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed." With us, it was just like that. Now, he just said a couple things that are really contentious there. You know, keep coming back, it gets better. Well, he just said certain low spots and trials ahead. Certain. They're certain. They're going to happen. And the way to deal with them is through work and self-sacrifice for others. And that's how you enlarge your spiritual life. And to perfect them. Now, I have a hard time with that. I'm a perfectionist myself. So how can I be perfect? How could I? I have found that very simply, the one way that I could be perfect is that at any given moment in my life, I could choose not to play God. It's as simple as that for me. And that's a perfect thing. I'm me, I'm not God. How perfect is that? I don't have to do everything. I don't have to run the universe. You know? So, with that, there's like 4 or 5 paragraphs left to the chapter. We got, what, about... I think I could... Let me whip through that for you. All right. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate for my old business associates remained skeptical for 1.5 years, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. We commenced to make many friends fast, and a fellowship has grown up among us, of which it is a wonderful thing to feel a part. The joy of living we really have, under pressure and difficulty. I have seen hundreds of families set their feet in the path that really goes somewhere. Have seen the most impossible domestic situations righted. feuds and bitterness of all sorts wiped out. I have seen men come out of asylum and resume a vital place in the lives of families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standings, and there is scarcely any form of trouble and misery which has not been overcome among us. In one western city and its environs, there are 1,000 of us and our families. That's Cleveland they were talking about at the time. We meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one might often see from 50 to 200 persons. Footnote, mine's 89. So the next one says, we are growing in numbers and power. 89's AA is composed approximately of 76,000 groups. I'm sure it's much larger now. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity. But just underneath it, there is a deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need to look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. It's important to note that it says utopia. Originally, it said heaven. And they didn't want to get into that argument theologically. So that's my experience with Bill's story. And I hope I help somebody tonight and somebody learn something. So we turn it over to the Q's, right? Questions, queries, comments, concerns, quibbles?
The Q's and the C's?
Q's and the C's.
The Q's and the C's. And the floor is open for questions, comments, queries, critiques.
Critiques?
Ah. Concerns?
We have a couple.
Yeah, was that the Oxford group?
Was which?
That it sounded like he built.
Well, Ebby was the part of the Oxford group. So, right, that's what the message that he carried in the steps process that he went through was based on what the Oxford group had done, and they expanded it to 6 steps later, and then 12 when they wrote the book. Yeah.
Over there on the wall, you'll see absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. Those are tenets of the Oxford group.
Yep.
And you'll see them throughout the book if you look for them. Sorry.
No.
Thanks. It says something about thinking, and the 10th step says that, we can use our minds once we've got to the 10th step. This is a proper use of the will. I just thought I'd throw that out.
Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. We get to a point where we can use our mind with assuredness. Okay, but throughout the entire process, in order to do, everybody talks about that, I can't think myself into right action, I can only act myself into right thinking. Well, every action is preceded with a thought. It's impossible to act without thinking. Even reflexive action has thinking. We just don't know because it's reflexive. So our thinking comes first, always. So even at the beginning of this, when we decide to come to AA, we thought. when we decide to take the steps, we think. So that thought always precedes action. So I always get into that with people like, oh, just do it. It's like, well, no, I want to know what I'm doing, why I'm doing it, and hopefully that it's safe for me, So it's important to really rightly to think. I mean, we can't be blind to things. That's when the cult stuff starts happening, where we just go, oh, we're going to just don't think, go to me. Why? Well, I was told to. Well, what do you think about that? Oh, I was told not to think. So that's a tough thing. But thanks for bringing it up. Appreciate that.
Yes, sir. My name's Ralph. I'm
not before. Hi, Ralph.
Something that's always been confusing to myself and in talking with others. If one does the steps in what might be considered a correct fashion, I understand that by the time you get to the bottom or around the 9th step, the promises are going to materialize. I don't know if it's acceptance set or whatever. But to me, that's one of the things that makes me is that the obsession to drink no longer exists. Which means to me that you've been restored to sanity, which is the second step, meaning that though I might periodically hear the voice that drinking would be maybe a good thing to do, I think it through and I don't respond or act on it anymore. if I hear it at all. And fortunately for myself, I do not. But if one does the steps correctly, and they still have that obsession to drink, as you experience possibly, does that imply that maybe you haven't done them correctly?
Well, to be honest with you, the obsession to drink and being restored to sanity are actually 10-step promises. So the 9-step promises that you talked about, they do start to come true, and it says quickly or slowly, but they always materialize if we work for them. So what I always have to remember is that it's in God's time and not mine. But if I'm going through that obsessive thought process, perhaps I'm not at the point where I'm fully baked, really. I mean, because I can go through that process and still... Because it talks about in the 10th step that we'll pay for such thinking and, with all sorts of absurd ideas and actions. You know, so I'm like, oh, okay, I got God. Because that's the whole purpose of the steps, to get that spiritual experience. So when we get there, we have it, like I had it. And my experience was I had a spiritual awakening. I thought differently about alcohol. But nevertheless, it was still because I was still simmering. So it took that long for that obsession to be lifted for that moment, for that miracle to happen of, like, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. So in my estimation and my experience was that I did the steps the way the book said to do, and I did it thoroughly. And anytime those misgivings come up, if I have a higher power to turn to, I'm always going to be safe. Because that's the whole point. You know, thinking the drink through won't necessarily do it for me. Because it talks about that in the book, too. Because sometimes I could think it through and go, oh, good, that's the outcome I want. You know, so I always have to, you know, and it talks about that, you know, a little later on in the book, where lack of power is my dilemma. So if I come up against a decision that must be made, the best that I can do is drink. That's the best that I can do. So if I have a higher power, it's going to take me in the right direction if I turn to that higher power every time, which is what's been my experience. Despite having the obsessive thought, I would turn to God and say, come on, let's go. What are you doing here? I did the steps, and I'm still thinking about it. So,
If I can just say one thing, because that's, I'm working with somebody, and that's, I don't know really where to go at this point, because they're still experiencing that enough.
Yeah.
And yet, I don't know, I feel like everything is pretty much okay. I don't know what to do, really, anymore. But I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's definitely in God's time.
So the redo and hammer this for that is not really the point.
No. No, as long as you're in the maintenance of it, and you're in the 10th, 11th, and 12th, and going through the process.
It will materialize.
Yes. Yeah, because that's the guarantee of it, if we work for it. Yes, sir.
Sally,
I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Sally.
And in step 10, it says, you know, we've entered the world of the Spirit. So if I'm in the world of the Spirit, at that moment, I'm not going to have an obsession to drink. I'm not going to have a thought to drink. But the problem is, we'll say it in the Spirit necessarily every second.
Right.
Now, I had the obsession to drink for a long time into my sobriety. But I'll bet you, when I was on my knees praying and I was in the presence of God, I wasn't getting the obsession to drink at that moment.
Right.
But then, you know, I got up to go to work. I started thinking all these negative thoughts, all these resentments, all these fears. Oh, what a mess I was. And I wanted to drink, and I wanted to die, and I wanted to kill myself. And, but if I'm in, you know, if I'm in the Spirit, we've entered
into the world of Spirit.
And so, you know, that's the thing of it. That's the whole thing of it, to this day.
Yeah.
The only time that I have in sobriety is being in the world of the Spirit and being right there
yeah.
in the presence of God. And so, you know, Bill also said that, and that's what I really wanted to comment on, what we were just reading.
Well, it goes back to on 14 where it says, fails to perfect and enlarge your spiritual life. So if you're doing that, like you talk about, you're in the world of the Spirit, and you're not in the world of the obsession of the drink. So it's just that constant renewal.